All right, folks, this is still Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're about to have a conversation with Shannon Murray, who's in town from Minnesota. She's putting together a Industrial Workers of the World wobbly song series. She's in town to work with one of our producers, Mark Gunnery. They're putting together some musical madness. Might talk a little bit about that as well. And we thought we'd talk to her about music and politics and what she's up to. And good to meet you. And welcome to Baltimore.
Thanks for having me here.
This is your first time here? No.
I think it's my third time in Baltimore, but my first time here in the studio.
So. There we are. Well, welcome to the studio. So, and you live way up north in Minnesota.
Yeah, way up north in Bemidji. We are the first city on the Mississippi River.
That's right.
It is.
Ours is the Mississippi. That's right.
Yeah.
So is that where you're from?
I grew up in Black Duck, which is an even smaller, more obscure town north of there, like 600 people. And I went to college in Bemidji, and that became home.
So it just stays home. It's home. So let's talk about some of the stuff you're doing. I mean, I really was, you were on the radio for a while there as well, right?
Yeah, I used to host a music program back home on my local radio station.
And what kind of stuff did you play?
Anything from punk to old obscure, mostly female jazz, really anything that I wanted to play. I kind of stretched the boundaries a lot, bringing in hip-hop and punk in the category of rock. Stretched the boundaries as far as I could.
So that's interesting. I never... You describe yourself on your website as a folk punk artist,
mm-hmm.
right? Describe that.
It's basically, I started playing music. I'm self-taught. I was actually really terrible at music as a child and got told repeatedly to quit. I just, perseverance, right? I worked really hard to train my voice and my ear. But on guitar, it was the same thing, self-taught. And I ended up just playing really fast and really hard, maybe out of, you know, some angst and anger and things like that about the world around me. And I actually never interacted with punk music until after somebody made that point or that connection. Like, you're a little folk punk. That sounds a little Riot Girl folk. And I was like, oh, that's such a cool way of putting it. And then they had to tell me that it was actually a genre of music that I'd missed my whole life. And so
I never thought about either. So this
I got educated.
But no, I mean, because yourself is beautiful. I mean, I listen to yourself on the website.
Thanks.
Got a great voice. And it is, I guess it's folk punk. If I listened to it and never heard of folk punk, which I really never thought about much, I think it was more like folk than punk.
Okay. Yeah, and that's okay. I think it's those categories are limiting, aren't they? It's nice to just
have
a little more space, but in order to come on shows like this and talk about your music, you have to define it, right?
So right.
I struggle with those definitions a lot and think about it a lot.
Because they want to put you in this little box. And this is,
exactly.
You fit into this little narrow place. This is who you are. This is how we define you.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've been fighting my whole life to get out of those tiny narrow boxes. So it's a constant struggle.
So how about that? Let's take a step back in history. I mean, the industrial workers of the world,
mm-hmm.
the Wobblies. I mean, that was a turn of the 19th and 20th century. They were this huge revolutionary workers organization. Joe Hill, the famous name for most people. Big Bill Haywood, other people like that. So talk about your... Why you went after their music? What drew you to it?
It sort of happened accidentally. I was hanging out at home with a friend, and we were reading through Rise Up Singing, which is a great collection of folk songs that Pete Seeger put together. And I stumbled upon Hallelujah, I'm a Bum. I'd never heard it. And I read the lyrics, and it resonated so much with me, and it was so funny and clever. And I started singing it in the wrong time signature, at the wrong tempo, with the wrong melody. I just sort of made it up. And then that.
Which is fine.
Which is great. That's part of the folk process.
Right. You make it your own.
And so that sort of led from that to finding where that song came from and just being. I'm a curious person. And I found a few more songs and I stumbled upon Utah Phillips' work with these songs. And that was really the moment where I fell
he
in love with
one
it.
One of the greats when it came to this kind of stuff.
He was, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it kind of started from there, and then I, my grandfather's cousin actually pulled me aside and let me in on this little family secret that my great-grandfather and his brother were both card-carrying members of the IWW, and that made me feel a little less alone in my politics with my family and sort of have a connection to this history that had been lost up until he pulled me aside and told me that.
North Country Woodsmen, is that what they were?
Yeah, yep, Lumberjacks.
Right. Lumberjacks, yeah. That's who they organized. That was one of the groups that got organized mm-hmm. by the Wobblies, the Lumberjacks.
Yeah.
Very cool. No, and it's tell me about the music for our listeners too, who may be not familiar with. I mean, movements have their music. I mean, the civil rights movement would have been nowhere without the heart of the freedom songs that everybody sang in the midst of the struggle. But and it seems like music has always been formed part of a core of a lot of people's struggles.
Yeah, right? I think it's very powerful. And the IWW used music in that sort of context to build power and lift spirits during protests. They used it as a tool for educating and organizing and bringing people into the movement. Of course, when you hear a song like Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, and you laugh at it and you can, it resonates with you, you feel something and you want to get involved, I'm sure. They also, I think, were pretty clever, too, in using church hymns, kind of stealing back music that had been stolen from the folk tradition and using that for labor organizing, too. So a lot of the songs were familiar in the same way that spirituals were used in civil rights organizing. So there's lots of interesting parallels.
So you have a guitar here.
I do.
And you started off by... You've called a Hallelujah, I'm a Bum a number of times.
That was the beginning. Yeah, it's a good little tune.
Do you want to sing it?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting too because it's over 100 years old and it sort of is it's joking about the celebrating being a bum. It's the kind of celebration where you're not really celebrating. You know, it's very sarcastic and. They say, why don't you work like other people do? How the hell can I work when there's no work to do? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Yeah, hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. And I went to a house and I knocked on the door. And the lady said, scram bum, you've been here before. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Yeah, hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. You know, this is supposed to be a sing-along too, so you are welcome.
Oh, you want me
to
say
that? No pressure.
No pressure, fine.
Well, I went to a bar and I asked for a drink. And they gave me a cup and said, there's the sink. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Yeah, hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Well, I love my boss. She's a good friend of mine. That's why I'm starving out on this bread line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Yeah, hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. And they say, why don't you save all the money you earn? I said, if I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Yeah, hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
I love that. That's really, really good. So here's what I'm going to do. Next time you do a song, I'm going to look it up so at least I have the lyrics and I can leap in.
You know, the problem with playing these sort of irreverently quick is that it's hard. It is harder to sing along. The original version is like...
slower.
Why don't you work like... Yeah, it's a little...
But you don't like that style.
You know, I...
Or it doesn't fit you.
Yeah, it doesn't fit me. And I've actually been thinking about this a lot and wrestling with it. I was on tour out west, and I stopped by Utah Phillips' grave to sort of just pay homage in Nevada City. Mm-hmm. And so spent most of the day trying to find the cemetery and then trying to find his grave and then sat down and realized that it was 8 years to the day that he had died.
Wow.
Which felt, I mean, coincidences like that always seem like they're full of meaning for me. And I went and grabbed my guitar and sat down and started playing this song. And I just started playing it in the slow 3/4
time.
The way
he does.
And
right.
I couldn't stop. And it was, and I'd never played it like that before. And it made me sort of think about it. I don't know if I'm going to switch back to that way, but switch to that way. But
so what is it about that way that doesn't appeal to you?
I mean, I think it's sort of.
Well, what is it about you that the way you interpret the song, it has to be kind of more driven and harder?
I think the slow original way that they're played appeals to me. I would love to sit and hear Utah Phillips play that way if I could go back in time. And I have seen him play it. But I think for me, when I perform, there's a lot of energy and it's sort of frenzied. And it just fits better with my style to play quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also opens up this music to a whole group of people that might not sit through the song that sounds like a hymn from a church. Really, and
no,
it
I
also
hear you. I hear you. Yeah, yeah,
it
yeah,
also
yeah,
in
yeah,
a way like yeah. My grandmother recognized the tune, even with me playing it incorrectly, and too fast, and she was able to sing along and feel a connection too. So I think sort
so
of
she knew the song as well.
She knew the church song to revive. There's like a revive us again song, and so I think that speeding it up sort of maybe creates a space where more people can access it, or maybe that's just where I like to be is playing things way too fast.
No. I mean, it's not too fast. It takes a lot more, I was going to use the word courage, and it is courage in a sense, of taking something that is played a certain way historically by most people and then kind of moving it around to the rhythm that you feel inside mm-hmm. and how you need to express that song.
Yeah, I've had a lot of conversations with people who are maybe a little offended by my choices, and I think it's okay, though. It's good to have all those conversations, and it's good for me to think about it, and I probably will still continue to stay the course and play it the way that... And really learning it from a book, I'd never heard this. It wasn't part of the folk tradition for me. I never sat in a room and heard my grandfather play this or my parents play it. And if I had, then I certainly maybe wouldn't have even diverged into something totally different. But because there was that disconnect for me and I was learning it from a book instead of a human and there's no audio recording for me in that moment, I just made it up.
And guitar, when you taught yourself guitar, did you teach yourself guitar by listening to a CD, watching something, or just picking it up and playing on your... How'd you do that?
Primarily the internet, looking up tabs and, listening to songs and playing.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
Oh, goodness. There's my Minnesota accent.
I heard that. I heard it, yeah.
I learned in my sophomore, junior year of college, so that would have been 2002, so 15 years ago.
Yeah.
It's been a while. I haven't thought about that.
There's a certain time when the Minnesota accent just comes running out. You can't stop it.
It does. Usually the longer I'm away from home, I start to get a little sad for it.
So, let's go back to the beginning here for a second, and what it, coming back to this old idea of the wobbly songs, which is what the industrial workers of the world were called. What do you think they had to say to us today?
I think they have a lot to say to us today. I think that we're dealing with many of the same struggles that they were fighting against. I think they were successful in winning a lot of things. Certainly, Mother Jones did a lot for child labor laws in this country, at least. But a lot of the products that we use every day and are made by children around the world. And I think that things like the 8-hour day, it's really easy for folks to forget where those came from and forget that there was a huge, long, painful, and oftentimes bloody struggle for folks to gain those rights. And I feel like we're taking a lot of steps backwards. And I think that also some of the same critiques that Wobblies had of capitalism are still really, really relevant today. And those voices are strong and they're there for us. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel to...
Is there a particular song that you think says that to you or said that to you? Among them, I mean, they all do that, but I mean, is there something that...
I think they're all in so many different ways. I mean, you look at, you mentioned Joe Hill. Joe Hill's song, The Preacher and the Slave, drawing a connection
between...
I was about
The Preacher and the Slave.
Between folks using religion as a tool of oppression.
Right.
And that song's really great. I found a poem that was written in 1917 called Sedition that's about free speech and about people being imprisoned for speaking out. And that was in response to the Espionage Act. And there was a similar act in Minnesota that was called the IWW Bill. And the first conviction under that was a guy from Bemidji, actually. And I found this in the process of doing more research in this project. It's sort of never-ending research. But Minnesota had the first conviction. He got 2 years for having Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's book Sabotage and distributing that, 2 years in jail. And like we look at folks like Chelsea Manning today, and we think about this concept of free speech, and that poem is really powerful. There's so many songs, I think, that speak to a lot of different things that
is there one that you'd like
today.
Another one you want to share that's in your head right now?
Yeah, I think so.
I could pick them. I'll let you pick them, though.
Oh, yeah.
I'll pick
part of my research, I got kind of cornered by our local librarian, and he asked me to do sort of a more academic presentation on this. And I started looking at the lack of songs about the women in the IWW movement. And even though the IWW was great in having women and people of color and immigrants not only organizing those folks, but having those folks as organizers, as founding members of the IWW, which was a pretty radical thing at that time, there was still sort of a missing... I think a lot of the history about those women is not as well covered as folks like Bill Haywood or Joe Hill. And so I wrote a song about Lucy Parsons, actually.
This song you wrote?
Yeah.
I love Lucy Parsons.
So it's an original, but it's in the context of this history. And I For her, I found all these words that she'd written that were pretty powerful and very militant.
So before you do that, before you jump into this, this is cool. Before you jump into that, I mean, people should know a bit about Lucy Parsons. Mm-hmm. I mean, people may not know the name. You know, we have a thing in town called Red Emmas. Emma Goldman, who was a revolutionary, but who did not, and she and Lucy Parsons did not get along very well, to say the least. But Lucy Parsons was a woman, and you can jump in and add to this too. I mean, it was a woman who was born enslaved in Texas. She was black and native, fell in love with a Confederate soldier after the war. They fought for the rights of black folks in Texas. They fought against the Klan. They had to flee to go to Chicago. The fact that, and it's a great love story. I mean, he became a revolutionary too, the ex-Confederate soldier, and he was one of the ones that. Haymarket, when the Haymarket Rebellion happened, that was the founding of the kind of modern labor movement, and he was executed because of that, and she kept the struggle up. I didn't stop, and but people don't know though this woman because we don't just whitewash women a lot, but in these kind of struggles today we whitewash women of color even more.
Mm-hmm.
People,
yeah.
You know, so people don't know the name Lucy Parsons like they know other people from that period.
It's true. And I found even like feminist scholars would put her as a footnote to her husband, which is just
She's been a footnote for everybody.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. And I like how you said then her husband became a revolutionary too, that she was the spark in
she
that.
Was
she
the
was
spark.
More right. outspoken and more militant than he was. And I think that had she been a man, she probably would have been in a similar situation.
And she kept speaking about this and fighting for it until she drew her last breath.
Mm-hmm. And she was so, I think, militant in her words, arguably because she'd seen so much violence at the hands of the state. And you kind of walked through this like, series of events in her life, and it's all very, very violent. And she was fighting that. Yeah, her whole life is pretty great story.
Right.
So, and one of the lines of hers that really...
And she was an anarchist. We might add that to it as well.
She was an anarchist, yeah. I think one of the lines from when I was reading her words that that struck me so much was sort of this like we're governed best where we're governed least, and sort of taking this old idea of like government does you know the Thomas Jefferson quote or the there's a couple
yeah the
ways.
Government the government that the is best the government governs least or something close to that. I'll find it.
Yeah, it's close. And Lucy Parsons sort of took it just one step further and was like, let's just get rid of all this altogether.
And she was also one of the founders of the IWW.
She was,
at the original founding of the convention.
At the founding convention. And she was one of the first people to point out that women were often used by industry as a way to lower wages. And I think that was an important piece that she gave to the IWW and probably informed a lot of that organizing.
Albert, that was her husband's name. Yeah. Albert. Right.
It's good that you forgot his name, though. I mean, it's not good. Isn't that good? Is the wrong word.
So this is a song you wrote from Lucy Parsons' words.
Yeah, I was inspired by her words. I wouldn't say I'm quoting her directly.
Okay.
It was sort of a
sort of sick, twisted, paternalistic thinking could lead one to believe that the people whose hands built these cities deserve none of life's liberties. And you may have all the money, you may make the laws that make it legal to steal, and you may think you've got all the power, but the people united have more power than you'll ever wield. We are governed best where we are governed least. We are governed best where we're governed least. Oh, no National Guard, no president, no police. We are governed best where we're governed least. We will fight for what's right with our actions and our words, and blades and bullets if we must. And I will light the fuse of this dynamite. No metaphors if it comes to that you can trust. I am fearless in the face of your authority, 'cause I gave you none over me. And You can lock me up in your prisons, but even threats of death will never inspire me to concede. And we are governed best where we are governed least. We are governed best where we're governed least. Oh, no National Guard, no president, no police. We are governed best where we're governed least. Rebel to the core, I speak the truth and nothing more. I have seen enough to know how this plays. Yet the disinherited must work out their own salvation in their own ways. Yet we don't need to be saved by your scriptures. No, we don't need your pie in the sky. Yet we're demanding wages equal to everything that we produce here and now, not by and by. We are governed best where we are governed least. We are governed best where we're governed least. Oh, no National Guard, no president, no police. We are governed best where we're governed least.
That's great. That's great. That's wonderful. I like that.
It was really fun. I got to play this in a library in Minot, and after the show, the librarian came up to me, and she's like, that song, like that line, you know, you were standing in front of the window that faces our police station the whole time, and I didn't know where the rest of the conversation was going to go. I was kind of waiting, and she's like, that was so great. You tell him.
Wow.
It's really interesting. Librarians are often...
Well, librarians are the best.
They're fabulous.
People, they are. They really are.
They read books. A lot of books.
They read books. They protect books.
Yes.
You know, and I was on the library board here for many years in Baltimore, and the woman who ran it, who's now just made the head of the Library of Congress,
okay,
Carla Hayden, she always saw the libraries as this place for is where poor people had access to books, to computers, to a place to be. You know, and that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I agree. The librarians are the ones who protected us during the. During the Patriot Act and everything else, they stood up. Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
Digress, but yes, I agree with you about librarians.
And it was my local librarian who kind of pushed me to dig deeper and do this. I had like 6 or 7 of these songs that I was playing, and he kind of asked me questions and guided me and mentored me in doing this larger, more academic presentation than I was used to doing and developing more songs like this one. And it was kind of.
So, what did you discover in that sojourn?
I found so many great things, especially that story about Bemidji's history with the IWW. There was actually an office in Bemidji, and right prior to World War I starting, there was a fire at one of the mills in town, and of course everybody blamed the IWW, and that was when the trial happened, and there was a number of deportations that happened where the IWW members were rounded up at gunpoint, led to the trains, put on the trains and sent out of town, and of course they'd come right back and do it again, which was similar stories like that were happening all over out in Everett, Washington, and down in Brisbane, Arizona. There's tons of stories that are similar to Bemidji's, but I didn't know that it had happened in my town. Hmm. And one of the prominent businessmen was a big supporter of the IWW. He was later the mayor, and he actually got threatened at gunpoint by the same citizens to stop supporting them, which he didn't stop doing. But Morris Kaplan was his name, and there's some very interesting...
Morris Kaplan? Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. He was a grocer in town. And so just learning some of that history in my town was pretty important, among other things, too.
So I'm curious what you think about where we are today with all this. I mean, unless I'm missing something, it seems like music does not play the same role in the movement as it did. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's a question that probably can be answered a number of ways. I think there's a lot of music that's inspiring folks to work for social justice. I don't think that we're seeing it in the same way maybe that we saw with the IWW or with the civil rights movement. I think it looks different. But certainly the ability of artists to be able to record and release a song days after some big event happening is something I think that's pretty powerful, to be sitting in Bemidji and to be able to hear. I think that for someone to be able to kind of send that out over the internet, there's power in that. But it's different than people being in the same space marching and singing together. I'm also pretty disconnected, unlike you all, where you're sort of just in the backyard of D.C. here. So there's probably a lot of access and opportunity to some of those larger protests. I'm sort of in a very, very small town. Yeah. Raising a couple of kids and working on different issues.
Oh, yeah, so you have kids. You're a mom.
Yeah, I adopted a couple kids about 4.5 years ago. So organizing for me looks very different. It's very community, small community focused.
That's what organizing is, though.
Yeah. And oftentimes I don't feel like it always reflects my politics, but I feel like there's some good movement going on in my community. But we're definitely not having the large protests in the streets in the same way. We've had some vigils. Maybe we do need more music. That's a good...
Here we do.
Yeah. You just,
and you're just down the highway from Rosebud up there.
Rosebud.
North Dakota.
Oh, you mean the Dakota Access, yes.
Yeah. You're just down the highway.
We are just down the highway, yeah. There's a lot. In fact, Indigenous Environmental Network is a great advocacy organization. They're based in Bemidji. And so
is that where their headquarters are?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah. Tom Goldtooth probably lives like 5 miles away from my grandma's house. And yeah, they're doing some really great work and they're all over there. So,
cool. Yeah. So what should we do now? You got something else you want to do?
Question. I don't know. And then I have a bunch of Joe Hill songs that are all really wonderful and have good, funny. He's such a good songwriter.
So as you start, for our listeners, let's not assume, talk a bit about Joe Hill.
Yeah.
And then I thought Joe Hill's will be interesting with the last thing he wrote before he was executed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Joe was probably, I mean, he was the most prominent songwriter in the IWW. He's the most famous, had the most notoriety. And that I think that was well earned. He was a pretty phenomenal songwriter. You can tell he was a funny guy. It just comes through in his songwriting and clever. Clever and funny. And probably charming too. You know, he's got all these songs that are just really, they're really endearing and take all these issues that are pretty challenging and put them in a way that makes you laugh. And whenever you can laugh at your own pain, I think that helps. It's therapeutic. There's so much power in that. And I think that's why he was so widely renowned as a great songwriter.
It was executed for a crime he most likely did not commit, a murder?
Yeah, and that part of his story is really interesting. There was a murder that happened, and he was shot on the same night that murder happened.
Right.
But, of course, it's circumstantial evidence at best to say that just because you have a gunshot wound that you must have committed this crime. That was the only evidence they had, and that's not really evidence tying him to the murder. And there was all kinds of evidence to point to someone else who probably did the crime, who had motive to harm the business owner that was shot. And so Joe Hill was, he was charged, he was found guilty, and then there was a huge movement to try and save him. So Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was involved. Helen Keller, who I think a lot of folks don't know, was involved with the IWW, was a huge socialist, was a very radical woman. Often her history gets whitewashed as well. She did a lot of organizing on his behalf, the Swedish prime minister. Eventually, Woodrow Wilson even stepped in. Joe was offered a pardon. He refused to take it. He wanted a new trial. And he basically said that if I can't get a fair trial, you know, like, what is the point of the judicial system if not to give us fair trials? And he wanted to right that wrong. And, of course, that wasn't going to happen for him.
Killed by firing squad. And when the sheriff said, ready, aim, Joey Hill screamed out, fire! Go on a fire!
Yep.
That's what he said.
Yep, defiant until the end.
To the end.
Yeah, yep. And he died 1915. And I think one of the interesting pieces of information that I found in my research was, so he was cremated and his ashes were sent out all over the world to be led into the air by IWW members. And that was shortly after his death, but I guess they were still being distributed a couple of years later. And in 1917, the U.S. Postal Service confiscated one of those envelopes for its subversive potential, which is interesting in and of itself. And they kept it. And I think it was like 1988 that they discovered it. It was in 88. And so there's this big debate over what should be done with these ashes. And, of course, the IWW, because IWW is still around today. A lot smaller organization, but folks are still, there's been a continuity of organizing throughout the time from when it started until now. And they ended up, I think somebody joked that Billy Bragg should be the one to ingest those ashes, sort of like carry on the tradition. Of course, Billy Bragg's a great songwriter. And he did, apparently. I sent a message inquiring as to the truth behind this story, because I was like, that sounds like a folk tale, right? But apparently Billy Bragg ate the ashes of Joe Hill. So around in,
Joe Hill's inside.
It's kind of a creepy story, also.
Depends how he's got him in, but we'll see.
Yeah. I'm whiskey, right?
Whiskey. Drinking whiskey?
Stir him into whiskey. That's like how I picture it in my mind.
You probably have to do that. Though ashes are heavy, you know. Like, if you put ashes in a river, they fall to the very bottom of the river. They just lay there for a while.
I've never tried this myself, so oh, goodness. But, yeah, this poem was the last thing that Joe wrote. It was called Joe Hill's Last Will, and he sent it out through the prison bars with his friend Bill Haywood. And I thought it was just a really beautiful poem and wanted to set it to music. And I believe other musicians, I know other musicians have set it to music, but I refused to listen to those before doing this because I wanted to do my own. My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss and moan. Moss doesn't cling to a rolling stone. And my body, oh, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let the merry breezes blow my dust to where some flowers grow. And perhaps some faded flower then would come to life and bloom again. Yeah, this is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill. Yeah, this is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you.
Beautifully done. Very beautifully done.
It's a beautiful poem.
It is. Shannon Murray, good to have you by the studio. Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And when's this album come out, the Wobbly album?
In November this year.
Good. We'll have to get you on by phone at least.
That would be great.
Do some more.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.